futuro.
Hey, welcome to In the Thick. This is a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
We've got a really important show today. Joining us from the Worcester. Oh my God, I got it wrong. From the Worcester area of Massachusetts is Manisha Sinha. She is author, historian, and the James L. and Shirley A. Draper Chair in American History at the University of Connecticut. Hey, welcome, Manisha.
Hi, Maria. Thank you so much for having me.
And joining us from Washington, D.C., see that one I can say real easy, Washington, D.C., is Gregory Jackson Jr. He's a gun violence survivor. We're so happy about that. And National Advocacy Director at the Community Justice Action Fund. Welcome, Greg.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. We're so happy that both of you are joining us. We're going to be talking about the epidemic of gun violence in this country, and it's for real. And the disproportionate impact that this has on communities of color. You know, we start off by grounding this show in gratitude and in emotion. And so last Friday on ITT, we talked about the fact that this violence has plagued this country since its inception. So this is not new. It's just another kind of deep, clear and present danger that we've had to live through over the past couple of weeks. Two of the most deadly mass shootings so far in 2021. And the trauma is felt differently for those who have experienced something like this themselves, those who have lost a loved one to gun violence. And, you know, then as a country, we're still in the process of constant grieving with the over 500,000 lives lost to the COVID-19 pandemic. So this is a pause to give the both of you a chance to share with us your temperature check, just kind of how are you doing? So let's start with you, Manisha. How are you doing?
You know, I'm fine, but I have to say that the constant mass shootings in this country is really getting me down. And the fact that nothing gets done, you know, I live very close to Sandy Hook. And when you murder, you know, young children in that fashion, because you have access to, you know, literally weapons of mass destruction, and nothing is done after that, you know, it's appalling. Every time I drive from my house to New York City, I pass Sandy Hook, and I see that. And then recently, the shootings of Asian American women predominantly. And then the other one in Colorado, it just never stops. And it feels traumatizing each time this happens in the United States and nothing is done after that.
Yeah, it does feel like, you know, it's over and over and over and nothing seems to change.
Right.
Greg, we do want to say we're so thankful that you're a survivor. But I'm sure that this has been a particularly difficult time. So what's your temperature check? How have you been doing?
You know, honestly, I haven't been doing that well. You know, this has been a really hard couple of weeks. And unfortunately, each one of these incidents are triggering in their own way. And, you know, you try to go on about your day, but it's been one after another. I mean, we had three more this weekend. And in our work, you know, we sometimes engage directly with other survivors and we hear their pain and their sorrow firsthand, but we also recognize that now they're a part of a community of survivors that continues to grow. You know, since I was shot, over 800,000 people have been shot or killed by gun violence. And so with each major incident, there unfortunately becomes a new era of activists and organizers and passionate individuals that I just wish didn't have to do that, you know? So it's been tough. It's been really tough, actually.
It's a new era of survivors, but also a new era of activists that will continue to take this on, Julio.
Thank you, Greg, for just grounding this and feeling that you could share that with us.
We appreciate it.
Yeah. We really appreciate that. And I think it's important because this is a story about, this is humanity, right? This is, you know, sometimes we look at this debate and it gets explained and dissected, and we forget the human aspect of it. And one of the things that we mentioned in our Friday show, we've also seen this, some commentators are pushing this inaccurate narrative that the pandemic paused mass shootings, mm-hmm. and now we're returning to the so-called normal. And it's really a reflection on how the media fails in its coverage of mass shootings, especially the impact of this gun violence on communities of color. In reality, last year was plagued by deadly gun violence. As The Trace reported, and I'm quoting, mass shootings only slowed under a commonly used but restrictive definition that leaves out most mass casualty incidents. When defined as incidents in which four or more people were shot in a public or private space, there were more mass shootings in 2020 than in any of the previous years for which data is kept, and that's according to Gun Violence Archive.
Damn.
Okay, so think about that. And these mass shootings happen disproportionately in Black neighborhoods. This epidemic of violence isn't viewed as what it actually is, which is a public health crisis. For years, physicians, surgeons, advocates, they've pushed for the shift in this narrative that also allows us to address the root causes of gun violence. Last week at the Senate Judiciary Committee, there was a hearing on gun violence following the shooting in Boulder, Colorado, and Democratic Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois advocated for this position as well.
We see the problem we're up against is a public health crisis. So what should we do about it? We won't solve this crisis with just prosecutions after funerals. We need prevention before shooting.
And recently it was reported by the New York Times that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, will resume funding the research of gun violence after a 25-year congressional imposed hiatus. So think about that.
That's stupid.
Yeah.
Greg, talk to us about how the media has fallen short of this coverage, especially when it comes to the impact of communities of color. And how can this shift in the media narrative so it is viewed as a public health crisis?
Yeah, I do want to acknowledge, I mean, that research thing is so important. You know, of the 30 leading causes of death in America, this is the least researched.
Wow.
And whoa. Yeah, it's madness. And even now, you know, this is the number one cause of death for Black youth, the number one cause of death for Black men under 44. And I think just that pause in research or lack of research for 25 years. I mean, we say Black Lives Matter. Wow. The money in research is not even prioritizing it. It's devastating, and it has a devastating impact on how we address it. You know, and what are the actual solutions? We haven't even explored the solutions from a federal perspective. Thank God there's a lot of universities and researchers at the local level who are passionate enough to continue to develop that evidence around what works and what doesn't work. But as a country, we've just kind of just overlooked death, you know. And again, this is 100,000 people a year that are impacted by this. And that's even a low estimate, actually. So it's devastating. And I think beyond the facts, those stats around individuals, there's no way to quantify how many families have been destroyed and businesses and future communities and neighborhoods and homes, you know, and just culture. And,
yeah,
you know, there's no way to quantify that. And I think one kind of interesting blessing is with COVID-19 is that everyone is feeling this outside threat. If I go outside, I might get sick and it might hurt me. If I go to the grocery store, I might get harmed. If I go down the street, I might get harmed. And the way that COVID has instilled that kind of fear in so many of us is how gun violence has plagued our communities for decades now. You know, and I think every American is getting a taste of what it's like to live in a world where it could be your last day at no fault of your own.
And there's an element of the dehumanization. I think that's the other thing that we're all kind of freaking out about, which is just like the constant dehumanization. So I want to quote via The Trace what this looks like. So, quote, there was the shooting in Charlotte, North Carolina in June of last year where gunmen fired more than 200 rounds into a crowded block party, killing four and injuring five others. 2 months later, in Washington, D.C., multiple shooters fired into another neighborhood block party, killing one and injuring 21.
Wow.
And in January of this year, gunfire erupted during a basketball game in a public park in Miami, injuring eight. None of these shootings, though, prompted multi-day news cycles or condolences from former presidents.
Right.
That is not normal.
Yeah.
These kinds of shootings, not normal, and they should be getting the attention that they deserve. So, Manisha, how do you understand how this media narrative can be, you know, like this is invisibility. How do we manage invisibility and changing the narrative to a public health crisis?
You know, we think about people like Greg who have transformed their pain into activism and are speaking up for people whose lives, it seems, does not matter to a lot of people, or we have normalized it. This is abnormal. It is an epidemic of gun violence. In fact, it's a pandemic of gun violence. Mm-hmm. And I just like the way that Greg compared it to the pandemic that we have been through. And our leaders, instead of cowering before the National Rifle Association and its enablers in Congress, should be taking a much stronger stance against this epidemic. You know, I think of the CDC starting to actually compile data on gun violence and then being stopped, being told not to do that.
Yeah.
You know, this was a political thing.
Yeah.
And I really think we need to change that entire narrative. Once we see this as an abnormal, as a travesty, really, in our lives, you know, we can start fighting against it.
Right.
And again, when we think about how this is discussed in terms of our particular concern in terms of people of color, right? The 2018 March for Our Lives movement, which followed the mass shooting at the Parkland, Florida high school, received a lot of media attention. And despite the movement's efforts, the kids' effort to shift the focus to talk about Black, Indigenous, and POC communities, activists from these communities who have been organizing for years.
Right.
But instead, the mainstream media basically propped up young white activists from the high school, you know, because gun control and gun rights, it is complicated. We are seeing more people of color who are strongly supporting gun rights, especially when it comes to self-defense and community safety. And we have to think about that. I mean, I grew up in a time when we knew the Black Panthers were armed. We knew that the Young Lords were armed. In fact, across all races, since the 1970s, gun ownership has shifted from things like hunting to self-defense.
Right.
And that's according to NPR. Part of the spike of gun violence last year resulted from more guns being sold to first-time buyers, according to The Conversation. We also know that with increased gun ownership, there's an increase in gun deaths. So, Manisha, in the historical context, what does the right to bear arms mean for Black and POC communities?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a really interesting history. And of course, it's defined by the history of slavery and racism in this country. So if you look at the Second Amendment, which is always used by people who want an unrestricted right to own guns, even weapon-grade arms, it called for a well-regulated militia. So yes, regulated, you know, something that would be regulated by law. So it's not a blank check to own guns the way many people who advocate indiscriminate gun ownership argue. But right away, in 1792, the federal government passed a law prohibiting Black men from joining the militia.
Mm.
It was a mark of citizenship that they were deprived of. And then if you look at the history, they are vulnerable because, in fact, they are subject to mob white violence, particularly if you see after the Civil War, there are all these armed white men that wreak havoc in Black communities. And it's the same time that when Black men join the militias after emancipation, this is after the end of slavery, many of those militias are disarmed. while white vigilantes run around, you know, killing people. And this is true not just against African Americans, but Native Americans, right. Mexican Americans,
right.
Asian Americans. You look at the history of lynching and extralegal violence. It's always targeting communities of color in this country.
Yeah.
So, yes, there is an argument to be made that, you know, certainly for people of color, that they would use, you know, guns or weapons in self-defense. Right. But the self-defense argument being used now, I think, is spurious, because we see that increasingly the people who need it for self-defense don't have those guns. They certainly don't have automatic rifles,
right.
which is not for hunting, which is not for self-defense. It is actually for hunting human beings.
Mm. Exacto.
It's to inflict maximum damage. These are, you know, war-grade weapons.
Right.
Do we need something like that? And what is the purpose of those war-grade weapons? It is to target other human beings. And it is usually to target the most vulnerable amongst us, which happen to be, in this country, always communities of color.
Yeah. And Greg, you know, as an advocate working to end gun violence, I'd love to hear from you about how Black, Indigenous, and POC advocates have been organizing to end this gun violence, and how you all grapple with leftist, feminist, and BIPOC efforts to arm and self-defense. How can we think about claiming agency, power, safety, self-protection for Black and POC communities?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely become a challenging conversation, because on one side of the coin, we've seen that when a firearm enters the home, it increases the likelihood of someone being harmed. And it's not necessarily a defensive weapon. It's an offensive tool, right, that you can use when you want to be on the offense. But at what moments do you need to be on the offense? I always remind people, when I was shot, if I had a firearm, I probably would have died, because instead of evading, I would have turned around to try to defend myself and would have been shot probably point blank. You know, and for anyone who's lived these experiences, you don't have a lot of time. You know, the movies make it seem like you can have a gunfight and protect yourself. But in the moment, you don't have time. There's no time. The only time you have is to get out of there and get away. And so I have to remind folks that, you know, protecting yourself, especially protecting your home, a firearm is not the number one way to get there. But that's where the gun industry comes in. They've been marketing this. You know, they are, every time a shooting happens, their sales spike.
Yeah.
And they'll do one advertisement in the suburban white communities about Black looters, and they'll turn around and do another advertisement to the Black community about hate crimes and attacks, and use that fear to fuel this narrative that a gun makes you safer, when statistically it's simply not true. And so we have two battles. We have a whole policy and change battle that we're fighting to make sure that, you know, our communities are getting the support they need, and that people feel safe in their own homes and their neighborhoods without the need to bring in a firearm. But then there is an entire culture shift in America where, unfortunately, the gun industry has spent decades marketing to us that this is the way, this is the American way, you know, is to have this firearm in your home, even if it means it may cost you the life of your child or your friend or your neighbor.
Right.
And so we got to keep pushing back on that, because it is creating multiple challenges in the movement to keep our folks safe.
I want to turn to what's being done or not by politicians to engage with all of this and actually try to end this. So President Biden ran on a campaign promise of sending a gun control bill to Congress on day one in office. And he's yet to do so. The House has passed two bills on gun control, but it's likely that these are going to fail in the Senate. And many are asking for federal action now.
Right. And on Friday, Change the Ref, which is a gun control advocacy organization founded by Manuel and Patricia Oliver, who are the parents of Joaquin, who was killed in the Parkland shooting, hosted a Zoom event. And here's how Manuel Manny Oliver put it.
Now, Mr. Biden, you are the president of the United States. I'm still the father of Joaquin, carrying my pain. And I will be the father of Joaquin, regardless who is the president of the United States. But as long as you are inside the White House, I need to go to you and ask you to go back to that conversation that we had. and start doing something together.
Yeah, that one, you know, Manny Oliver always hits home with me a lot because, you know, I have a son named Miguel, and when I hear Joaquin, it's, you know, he was the same age, you know, teenager, and it really just, anyway, but Biden has a long history of fighting for restricting gun laws, but let's be clear, these victories were part of the 1994 crime bill and were won at the expense of further criminalizing Black and brown communities. And even as vice president in the Obama administration, following the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School mass shooting, he failed, you know, that administration failed to pass sweeping legal changes.
So the Biden administration has had some meetings with gun control advocates, but early invites weren't extended to leaders of, for example, Black-led violence prevention organizations. This despite, like we've mentioned, the rise of violence in majority Black communities over the past year. So what's up with that? Prior to the inauguration, the Biden team did work with Amber Goodwin, the founder of your organization, Greg, the Community Justice Action Fund, or CJAF. And there have been more recent reports that the administration has met with POC and youth-led groups. So that's good.
Good, yeah.
But are Democrats doing enough? And can we trust the party that has previously pushed gun control policies that further police and criminalize our communities? You know, Greg, can you talk to us about what your organization and other advocates are calling for with the Biden administration and also beyond the Biden administration?
You know, I think this all starts with we need to acknowledge this is a public health crisis. And that was one of our first demands of now President Biden. And on December 14th of 2020, he did that. And he acknowledged this is a national health crisis. And so now we're saying, OK, now that you've gotten past that, this is more than just about crime control, that this requires a health response like any other major health crisis. Then what does that look like? And so we're advocating for funding, $5.3 billion, to be invested as a starting point in some of the known solutions to address gun violence in our communities that focus on public health strategies and community-based strategies, programs that provide mental health support and rehabilitation for folks who are recovering from an act of gun violence, programs that target those who are most at risk of being a survivor or a potential perpetrator of gun violence, and providing them with wraparound resources and services to hopefully help them down another path.
Yeah, you know, and that's interesting because despite polling showing the majority of Americans favor some gun control measures, Republicans and the National Rifle Association, the NRA, continue to impede efforts for legal reform. Mm-hmm. Republicans have shifted blame to the movements of Black Lives Matter and defund the police for the rise of crime and gun violence, which there's no evidence for.
Just making stuff up.
Mm-hmm. You know, even as we're watching a trial of Derek Chauvin this week, you have even the people that are out, you know, I was watching the live stream on Monday and, you know, people are just like peaceful. I mean, there's nothing happened on Monday. Right. You know what I mean? So, but that's what they gravitate to. And on the contrary, right, this is a fact. It's right-wing and white supremacist protesters who show up armed, right? Like at the Michigan State Capitol last
protest,
year.
Exactly. Their protest is like, hi, we come with arms.
Right. And also, right. Maria, you know, Maria and I always talk about this. When we were in Cleveland in 2016 at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, I had never seen so many white dudes open carrying walking around downtown Cleveland. Right, Maria? Like, it was a moment for me. I'm like, what the hell's going on?
Yeah.
And then more recently with the January 6th insurrection, you know, someone was shot and killed.
Yeah.
So there, you know, that was an example of like, there it is. If you're bringing this tension and you talk about more guns around, that's what's going to happen. Then you have Republicans in states like Texas and Georgia, who are pushing for voter suppression bills instead of addressing the gun violence epidemic. And Senator Ted Cruz was one of many Republicans at last week's Senate hearing that used the moment to push the anti-gun reform agenda.
And every time there's a shooting, we play this ridiculous theater where this committee gets together and proposes a bunch of laws that would do nothing to stop these murders. senator from Connecticut just said the folks on the other side of the aisle have no solutions. Well, the senator from Connecticut knows that is false. And he knows that's false because Senator Grassley and I together introduced legislation, Grassley-Cruz, targeted at violent criminals, targeted at felons, targeted at fugitives, targeted at those with serious mental disease, to stop them from getting firearms, to put them in prison when they try to illegally buy guns.
Mm. Okay. Ted Cruz, who was down at the border looking silly, like he's going to stop everything himself. Okay, so this was an important piece of data. Only 30-40% of households in this country actually own guns. But what we do have is a super powerful, loud gun lobby that continues to impede change. So people want the change, right?
Yeah.
It does seem that we need to have some federal action on gun control, but there's also the issue of the filibuster, right? And its racist history, despite Mitch McConnell consistently denying that. In fact, the Senate filibuster that has been talked about has, in fact, been used to prevent gun control laws from passing before. So, Manisha, can you break down the history of the filibuster and how it's a part of Republicans and the NRA's overall efforts to essentially impede gun control reform by using the filibuster?
Yes. So Mitch McConnell's sense of history is clearly not as good as, you know, most historians. We know that the filibuster,
there it is.
Even though it started being used in the mid-19th century, was preeminently used by slaveholders and segregationists to basically block legislation that would in any way impede the rights of slaveholders and later on any legislation for Black political and civil rights like anti-lynching laws or voting rights for Black people or civil rights for Black people. And you can literally go back, you know, in the past 100 years or more and show that the filibuster has been used preeminently to stop racial progress in this country, which is vested in Congress. So I think it's really unfortunate, the situation we are in. We have such a narrow majority in the Senate.
Yeah.
And within our 50 that we have someone like Joe Manchin who has been very reluctant to do away with the filibuster, but he's also, you know, a bit of a gun nut. They have all these advertisements showing themselves with automatic rifles shooting up things. I don't know whether they think that makes them look very particularly powerful, but, you know, they all look like members of a terrorist group, which they very well might be, considering the way in which they are blocking any change on gun regulation. They have the blood of American citizens in their hands. And, you know, Ted Cruz, I mean, it appalls me that a man like him is even in the Senate. You know, no principles, no decency. But that little act that he put up in Congress, where he completely tried to rewrite the narrative of gun reform into some sort of controlling criminals somewhere is appalling. But that's what they do. They traffic in lies, in propaganda and racism, and in appealing to the worst parts of our nature.
Yeah.
And we need to counter that. I think he gets way too much press, really, Maria and Julio.
A move to mute Ted Cruz. Interesting.
I love it.
You know, it's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting you say that. But just to paint a picture of how this toxic masculinity plays out, here's some data that I want to share. About 40,000 people die from gun-related violence, suicides, and accidents each year in the United States. And that's according to the Gun Violence Archive. And among other wealthy countries, the United States ranks the highest, number one, top country when it comes to gun homicides. And there's no question we have the highest private gun ownership in the world. There are more guns than people in this country.
Damn.
That's, you know, that is a uniquely American fact. And like you both have mentioned, and Maria as well, it's rooted in toxic masculinity.
Name it.
It's men who are responsible for most gun violence, and that's according to the 2017 data provided by the FBI. And it's mostly women and children who are victims of gun violence and accidents. Hmm. So in some ways, this outdated notion that only men can provide, quote, protection is in itself rooted in toxic masculinity and mm-hmm. actually leads to gun violence. So mm-hmm. we know that intimate partner violence is a serious issue that can prove deadlier when abusers access firearms. So yet, with all that, the Violence Against Women Act expired in 2019. And while the House did recently vote to reauthorize it, 172 House Republicans voted no.
Just like no.
Think about it. Mm-hmm. So we know it's going to likely face Republican opposition in the Senate. Greg, talk to me about white supremacy, toxic masculinity, militarization. It's all there, right? I mean, this is what's feeding into sort of this gun violence culture, right? Mm-hmm. I mean,
yeah.
Is it that simple?
It's that simple, but I think one thing we're overlooking is what's driving a lot of this is dollars, you know, big business. Yeah. I mean, the gun industry is big business. We did some work with Amnesty USA and the Center for American Progress, and we were doing some international advocacy around this crisis and how this is a human rights crisis now for America, this lack of action and how it's uniquely impacting us. And one of the things I'll never forget was we had survivors from Mexico who said that 70% of the firearms pouring into their country is coming from here, you know? And so I never want to miss that moment to acknowledge that this is white supremacy, but it's also, there's a real machine behind this. And it's not just the NRA. It are these big gun industries that are manufacturing and just playing both sides and fueling this flame of fear and hate and using it against each other to profit. We have to call them out for being a part of the problem and being the fiscal engine behind fueling all this. But then we have to take a serious inventory of our values of our country and figure out how do we dismantle this white supremacy and frankly, the institutions that are feeding off of it. Unfortunately, at this point, to save lives. I mean, we've seen yeah. this over and over and over again. We saw what happened in Charleston. That was part of why our organization was founded, where it was a white supremacist moment of attack when Black people were killed in church, you know, in church. And here we are looking at, you know, hate being played out in all of these different situations for now decades. And yet we're still hearing people like Cruz defend it, you know. It is outlandish. And I think that there are just so many ways that we can attack this. But we do have to make sure that it's not just about firearm access. It's also about dismantling these institutions and frankly, policies like stand your ground laws that encourage, you know, the use of lethal action when you are exercising your prejudice or your discriminatory opinions or feelings towards other folks.
Right. Hey, big shout out to Greg Maria, because he's mentioning guns going into Mexico. Ding, 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 ding. More context. Because that was the Fast and Furious program, right?
Yeah.
It was a federal operation in the United States that ran from 2009 to 2011 under the Obama administration, just saying. Mm-hmm. And it was a program, an operation that was also from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, where they purposely allowed firearms to be sold illegally to suspected gun smugglers in Mexico because they claimed that the weapons would be traced back to cartels. Yeah, that didn't happen because the U.S. government literally lost track of hundreds Jeez. Of those guns, and many were eventually traced to violent crimes. I mean, no one talks about that, about Fast and Furious.
They don't.
So I'm so happy that Greg brought it up.
Mexico understands that the dynamic goes that our Mexican people, well, they used to come to the United States for work. I mean, at a zero, basically, now. We would come to work, but what does the United States send back? It doesn't send back its brightest or its best. It sends guns.
Yeah.
Right.
That is why there is gun violence in Mexico, because of the capitalist need that Greg just brought up.
Yeah, great
to
point.
To sell.
Yeah, Manisha, what are your thoughts about, I mean, I think you kind of already want to mute Ted Cruz, so I know where you're standing on this, but what are your thoughts about this issue?
Absolutely. So, you know, it is big money, just like slavery was. It's exactly what they said. Mm-hmm. You know, it's in the Constitution. It's protected by the Constitution. But it was also big money for the United States. And I'm really glad that Greg brought up that point about the profitability of the gun industry in this country. It is big business. And it is a business that needs to be regulated. It's a business that actually, frankly, should be put out of business. But your earlier point, Julio, I think is important too, about how gun violence is linked to domestic abuse. Mm. There's so much data that shows us that a lot of these perpetrators of gun violence have a history of domestic abuse. Mm. You know, you keep hearing the Republicans talk about, you know, mental illness. They always talk about that rather than gun regulation, though they, of course, don't want to put any money towards it either. But they don't talk much about domestic violence, and they're not willing to be decent human beings. I mean, who votes against an act to prevent violence against women?
Seriously.
It's like your humanity is compromised. Leave alone feeling empathy for people, but you have no sense of what is basic human decency and human rights.
Okay, so let's move on to our final segment, which we call La Última y Nos Vamos. The last one before you go.
The last shot of tequila before you go.
Hey.
I could use a tequila, right? And it's Monday at noon right now. It's just like, well, okay.
Okay.
So we're going to end by looking at history and the broader abolitionist movement in the context of gun control reform and civil rights. So Manisha, in 2016, you were interviewed for Slate, and you said that this is an issue of human rights, and that as a historian of slavery, abolition, the Civil War, and Reconstruction, you explained that there are some lessons we can learn. You said, quote, "There were all kinds of reasons for people to be anti-slavery in theory, and yet do nothing against slavery practically in action, in laws. This hand-wringing that we have about gun violence is exactly the way many well-meaning people talked about slavery. And that's why abolitionists were willing to take on the system, as it were, and to do something about it. They were radical, right?" So Manisha, last one before we go. What does the history of abolition teach us in terms of the fight to end gun violence, especially as we've seen the abolition movement that includes abolishing the systems of our own criminal justice system, the prison system, police, ICE? So what do we need to learn from the history?
I think the abolitionists are a good role model for that because they operated at various levels. It was the level of grassroots community activism, protests, changing public opinion on this, resisting the kinds of ideas that slaveholders and their allies in Congress constantly put out, and pushing at that time, you know, their allies, the Republican Party, because the Republican Party then was the party of big government and anti-slavery.
Right.
You know, the parties have flipped roles right now. But pushing their allies within political parties and the president to take action. Now, President Biden has said that he might think of executive actions if Congress does not do anything against gun violence. And I think it is so important for us to work at all those levels, in our state legislatures, in the federal level, with the president. You know, so many states have really good gun laws, but if your neighboring state doesn't, then it flows into your cities.
Mm-hmm.
So we need a federal response, as the abolitionists understood. For slavery, we need a similar thing for gun violence. You know, why is it that a country like Australia has one mass shooting and immediately
over
a law is passed?
Done.
It's, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's yeah. Over and done with. You know, certainly you can see that, you know, in New Zealand too, after the shooting in Christchurch. And so, you know, it's just the United States where this has become part of our normal existence, something that is so abnormal the killing of other people.
Right, right.
On a systematic basis. And so, yeah, I do think that we can learn from the abolitionists to work at various levels, to be activists on the streets, but also to really fight for political change at the federal level. And if that means constantly going at it, which the abolitionists did for three decades before they finally got something during the Civil War, we just have to continue with it because we can't accept it. We can't accept this.
Right. And we know that the more guns there are, the more violence and death there is. And this is also true with policing. The Atlantic reported, and I'm quoting, "When guns are abundant, civilians are more likely to kill civilians and cops, and cops are, in turn, more likely to kill civilians." And Greg, you said in an interview with Mother Jones that, quote, "police violence is another form of gun violence."
Yeah.
And you and CJAF have pushed for gun violence prevention organizations and advocates to also take this stance. So when we look at the history of abolition in this country and where the movement stands now with abolishing the current criminal justice system, how do we need to reimagine the solutions to gun violence to create safety in our communities, Greg?
You know, Monday is just a tough day because of what happened to George Floyd and the trial that's happening at this moment around this issue.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And we acknowledge police violence as gun violence because if those officers weren't armed, someone would have stepped in, right? No one would sit there and watch someone be killed slowly without intervening or trying to help. And also, we always come back to, you know, why does this happen? With every one of these police violence situations, when you look at the original conflict, they're so small, you know, $20 was what he was killed over. And our approach to our communities right now, because it's such a crime control, you know, mentality around it, is that we forget the person that's behind the conflict. You know, someone has a fake $20 bill is probably desperate to get their groceries or desperate for whatever they're trying to purchase. And so is our approach focused on solving the problems that lead to crime or just cracking down and incarcerating our communities? And so we're advocating pretty aggressively that gun violence prevention organizations need to also be fighting for criminal justice reform and just an overhaul of that entire system. But criminal justice reform organizations should also be advocating for public health resources and investments and community-based solutions to address violence. Because we can't have one without the other. We can't overhaul the criminal justice system without addressing the root causes and risk factors that lead to violence, because violence is a real, unfortunately, crisis. That whole push was, how do we bring those two worlds together and show the intersection of both, but also show that America's history of meeting violence with violence or meeting chaos with this law and order approach is only fueling more violence and harming more people every single day. And it's also reinforcing that that's how you handle disagreements, you know, that you bring in someone with a bigger gun. And that's backwards. You know, it's backwards to how we solve this problem, but it's also backwards to how we end violence and create a safer, more peaceful community.
Right.
Yeah, there are a lot of things about this country that feel backward. And it's, you have both given us a lot to think about and a lot of context. So we really appreciate that. Manisha Sinha, historian, professor at the University of Connecticut, and Greg Jackson Jr. is a survivor himself of gun violence and is the National Advocacy Director at the Community Justice Action Fund. And thank you so much to the both of you for bringing it with facts and with feelings on this episode of In the Thick.
Thank you
so much, Maria, from Worcester.
Okay, she just corrected me.
Uno, dos, tres.
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
So remember, dear listener, go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us when you have these moments of like, wow, that was so smart and I learned so much. That's the moment to rate and review us because it really helps us. Remember, you can listen to In the Thick on Pandora, Spotify, wherever you choose to get your podcasts on. Check us out on the web at inthethick.org. Follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook. Tell your friends and family to listen because it makes a difference. In the Thick is produced by Nicole Rothwell, Noor Saudi, Harsha Nahata, and our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow, Lisa Salinas, with editorial support from Erica Dilday. Our audio engineering team is Stephanie LeBeau, Julia Caruso, Leah Shaw, Elisheba Itu, Rosana Caban, and Gabriela Baez. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. Thanks to Raul Perez for recording me. The music you heard is courtesy of Nacional Captain CCK Records. Woo! See you at the end of the week, dear listener. Thank you so much for pushing play and for listening all the way to the end. We love you. Ciao.
Stay safe, y'all. Peace out.
The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees.